Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. Thanks to the organizers and Siv in particular for putting this together. It's a very interesting workshop. This will be more about tumor control. The title of the workshop has growth and control. I'll speak mainly about chemotherapy agents, and the modeling part is what we do. However, I grew a bit impatient, and I did a lot of testing on the side because, you know, it's part and parcel of what we do. Models have to lead somewhere. Okay. So first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the collaborators and the students, group members, and the funding. Speaking of the Alberta Advantage, most of the funding actually comes from the Alberta Cancer Board and the ALLER Foundation, all local sources, but other sources exist as well, although they are minority players these days. So we'll start from the basic principles of drug discovery and development. This is a very long and arduous route, and it's actually one of the most failure-prone activities that mankind has known. I challenge you to find something which is more prone with failure than this, because at best, 1 in 100,000 compounds ends up being used, and then 1 in 10 fails in the marketplace. So this is a terrible activity to be involved in. On the other hand, the payout is very good, and if you make it there, then you're talking about billions of dollars of revenue. And there are many stages of drug testing, and I will just isolate three components of it. The first one is finding a target, and we'll talk for a few minutes about targets. The second is finding a hit to the target, and that's on the halfway through. And then from finding a hit, you have to optimize and find a lead, and then the lead will be taken over by testing clinical trials. So the hypotheses are very complex, involve chemical, biological, physiological aspects, and the testing of hits involves the mechanism of action and dose response and pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics. And eventually you have to optimize, as is well known. I mean, every drug that we take, even aspirin, has side effects. And chemotherapy drugs are very toxic, so they actually have horrendous side effects, and much of the work is directed towards eliminating or reducing side effects. So for us, in terms of modeling, we have to first of all look at a druggable target. What is a good druggable target? And these will be either proteins or DNA, and there's fragments, domains. So finding a library of targets is something very useful, and this is what physicists, bioinformaticians, mathematicians can do. Resistance comes later, because there is never a perfect target. Whatever you do hits many targets at once, and some of these targets shouldn't be hit. So, and then there is, of course, the whole aspect of somatic mutations and the targets evolving during the course of treatment. Pharmacodynamics, pharmacokinetics, these are also modeling aspects of great importance. I'll skip the rest. This is our system, and I think Siv in the introduction mentioned something very, very similar, actually, looking transparency, which hits the nail on the head. That is, we have hierarchical arrangement of the system, and we can have a very good molecule that at the level of molecular modeling seems to be doing the work, but as you go higher and higher, eventually it loses its appeal because it does other things as well. So this hierarchical arrangement is something that we still don't have a grasp on, and many of these failures correspond to the, you know, going from hierarchy from subcellular to cellular to organ to full body properties. So these are the targets I mentioned, mainly proteins and mainly functional proteins, and narrowing it down to cell cycle maintenance proteins, because cancer is a disease of multiple failures of cell cycle checkpoints. The good thing about cancer as a target is that it has to do with more rapid division than normal cells, and especially dividing cells. So if we target all the cell cycle checkpoints that have to do with division, then you right away eliminate a lot of cells which are not dividing. This is just an overview of druggable targets so far. As you know, the human body produces hundreds of thousands of proteins, if not millions, and only 400 proteins altogether have been targeted by the drug industry. So we have a huge way to go. And out of the 400 proteins, I think 80 are used in cancer therapy only, so a fifth of that. And they are divided into various families. I'll skip that as we go into specific cell cycle applications. And here already is one of my favorite targets I'll spend a chunk of the talk on, which is this mitotic apparatus. No eukaryotic cell will divide without microtubules, for example, and so this is a natural target to hit. Tubulin is the building block of microtubules. But there are other targets, and many successful chemotherapy drugs on the market, and I've highlighted them in white. So this is comprising 80 drugs and drug candidates for cell cycle proteins, and they are listed here, different phases of the cell cycle, the types of proteins. And here we have, for example, CDK1, drugs that target that particular protein, and then we have tubulin. And tubulin is one protein but has many targets on its own, and I'll show you those. And for each target, you have different drug families. And in fact, for some targets, you have several drug families as well. So you have to keep it in mind, especially when you think about combination chemotherapy, which is all the rage today. No single drug is ever administered. It's always combinations of several, and ideally, several are non-competing drugs. And you have topoisomerases and DNA synthesis. And DNA repair protein is also very important, because you can target DNA synthesis, but then or DNA breakage, and then you'll have proteins that will repair it. So you have to go after the second target right away. This is the cytoskeleton, which is comprised of actin filaments, were mentioned in an earlier talk, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. And for each of these targets, you may have drugs that are inhibited by, for example, actin by cytochalasin B, and microtubules by many drugs, including colchicine, which will figure prominently in this talk today. Targeting actin would be a bit foolhardy, because then you would have horrendous side effects everywhere. And maybe microtubules is a better target, because it's they're only formed in dividing cells or in the brain, where they stay put all the time. So this is the kind of division of conventional chemotherapy compounds into targets: DNA, DNA processing enzymes, microtubules, and anti-angiogenesis compounds. And you can think of combinations of these into doubles or triples or even four compounds at a time. But there is a rub to it, because, as I mentioned, we seem to be using the word targeting or targeted a bit in a cavalier fashion, because we never have a single target. We always have, this is a protein interaction network, and you have the red blots showing you each of these drugs affecting many, not just the target of these proteins, and also depending on the concentration. So first of all, now we will be looking at how to model these things. If we know the target we want to go after, how do we find a molecule that will do the job? And that's at the very low level of of molecular testing. Many of these will be rejected at higher stages of testing, as I showed you in earlier transparencies, but let's not worry about it too much. Let's just find an ideal match for the target. So if we find cavities on our protein of choice, especially cavities that will normally be filled with some protein-protein binding parts or by ATP activation, then this would be a very good target for our ligand to interact with. So most of the job is to find a geometrical fit, and I think mathematicians can do that. This is a challenge, actually, I'm throwing at some of you, because probably it has to do with a lot of with differential geometry, although there are kind of brute force techniques using just all atom simulations with molecular dynamics and quantum mechanics, molecular mechanics. So you can also address the problem by filling a void with spheres representing atoms, and building a molecule atom by atom if you want. Whether this is a stable compound is another issue that's for the chemist to answer, but I think the first approach can be done at the level of geometry. This is a fairly complex problem, though, because if we want to choose from the in the protein data bank, we have 48,000 proteins as of today. Many of those are animal. About 4,000 proteins are human. So this could be your first broad selection of targets, and then you look after the functional ones. Each protein may have many pockets, maybe between 5 and 50 or so. So we are talking about hundreds of thousands of possible targets to look at, even if you just limit it to human proteins. As I mentioned, NIH actually identified 1,500 proteins as druggable, and as I mentioned earlier, 400 are utilized, 80 in cancer. The Orange Book, which is kind of the Bible of the medical profession, has 1,800 medicinal drugs used in North America. So it's a very small subset, actually, and plus some investigational drugs. At the University of Alberta, we have apparently the largest drug bank, virtual drug bank, accessible publicly, which is 4,900 drugs. And there's 103 chemotherapy drugs in use in North America and Europe today. So these are manageable numbers, but require a lot of computational power. And the combinatorial possibilities are infinite if you talk about multiple targets and combination therapies. So let me just talk a bit now about microtubules as a target and be more specific. These were kind of introductory comments about how this problem arose in the first place. This is a microtubule reconstructed by the computer from tubulin alpha and beta monomers in red and blue. And it's a hollow cylinder with 25 nanometer diameter and spanning the size of the cell, because it has to reach from the centrosome to the chromosomes, typically about 10 microns long. It's a dynamic polymer, protein polymer that requires GTP, a source of energy for its functioning, for its growth, and hydrolyzed to GDP causes disassembly, in a nutshell. So the families of drugs which actually address all aspects of microtubule dynamics, namely inhibition of growth and prevention of polymerization and depolymerization. This is just a time series of polymerization of microtubules from different isoforms. So again, another complication that as physicists and mathematicians we should keep in mind is that you talk about a protein, let's say tubulin being a protein, but it exists in multiple forms depending on isoform, which cell in the body it comes from, and as a distribution, and B, mutations will also have changes in the structure of the protein. These changes may occur in the binding site, importantly, and then, of course, your drug may be worth nothing because the pocket has changed. So all of this will add to the complexity of the problem you want to model. And as often, I think nature gives us a lot of hints, and here is... So microtubules are regulated in cells, not by drugs, but by other proteins. And there are proteins listed here which bind to the surface of microtubules, to the tips, both negative and so-called positive is the fast-growing tip. And therefore, as we find out later on, the existing drugs actually mimic the action of the proteins, which is kind of interesting. These are the three modes of action on microtubules of three families of drugs, vinblastine and vincristine, all the vinca alkaloids, which actually are used in leukemias and lymphomas heavily, and all the pediatric oncology, bind to the tip of the microtubule and stop the polymerization. Then we have colchicine, which is not in use in chemotherapy, was in trials, binds to the alpha-beta dimer and prevents polymerization. And paclitaxel and docetaxel, its close relative of the taxane family, also heavily used in breast, ovarian, lung cancer. They bind on the inside, so this is the inside surface of microtubule, and stabilize microtubules, preventing them from depolarizing. So if you form a microtubule and bind to chromosomes, the next stage would be pulling the chromosomes apart and depolarizing microtubules, and that would complete the cell division, anaphase. But if you stabilize microtubules, anaphase will never happen. So the cells which are treated with paclitaxel will then opt to go into apoptosis instead. And different drugs administered in live cells show a change in the dynamics of microtubules. So clearly, this is the target they go to, and they affect their dynamics. So we have to think about dynamical effects. Another clue from nature is that virtually all the drugs that I've mentioned so far and will mention in the rest of the talk have the origin in nature. And they either are extracts from plants, or marine organisms, or microorganisms. And that involves vinca alkaloids, taxanes, lanolides, telastatins, epothalones, which is a phase 3 clinical trial drug targeting the same binding site as paclitaxel, and colchicine, which has been known to humanity for more than 1,000 years. So now, but today, I think we are in a very fortunate situation that we can understand the action of these drugs at the lowest level, actually going down to the single atom. And that's where physicists are good at, I think, if they can model systems at the level of individual atoms. So that shows you how a microtubule from experimental micrographs can be seen, reconstructed by the computer, its binding block, its building block, tubulin, is shown here with all the alpha helices and beta sheets. And this is an illustration from three different sides of tubulin where the important motifs occur. The M loop is absolutely crucial in the stabilization of microtubules, and this is where, as you will see in a second, paclitaxel intervenes by making contact with this M loop and stabilizing the conformation of the tubulin dimer. So now I have to step back for a bit. We have the genetic code, information encoded by genes as to how to make proteins, and this gives rise to the sequence of amino acids building a given protein. This is, for example, the sequence for tubulin, so-called primary structure is given. And then the secondary structure gives you the motifs, alpha and beta helices in particular. Then you fold it into a tertiary structure, three-dimensional geometrical representation of the protein, and then quaternary is higher organization of these proteins, like a microtubule. Now, let's go back to the beginning. If we change a few letters here and there, make substitutions, sometimes single mutations will occur. Some of these are significant, will occur in the binding site. We would be able to trace the substitution into the structure of the protein. if we know that, then we can understand sometimes why some drugs don't work and what to do to make new variants of the same drug so that they will work. This is, I think, at the sort of rising front line of pharmaceutical research, because we don't have individual drugs yet. Especially in cancer, you have maybe cohorts of patients which overexpress some particular protein, and they may be classified into one regime of treatment, but not individual patients with single point mutations. But in the future, I'm sure, maybe 20 years from now, first the biopsy will indicate the type of mutations, some single nucleotide polymorphisms, and then the drug will be selected from a library that corresponds to the particular type of change. So this is what we did for tubulin. We've actually reconstructed by computational models all the isoforms of tubulin in the human. There's nine betas and eight alphas. And then we also looked for mutations which are recorded in the literature, especially those mutations of tubulin that are known to be associated with drug resistance. And we followed the advice of Mary Ann Jordan and Len Wilson, who said that if we know the tubulin isotype composition, we could, in principle, design drugs for this particular composition. And luckily, beta 3 is one of those forms of tubulin which is overexpressed in many cancers, so we tried to target that first. This just shows you that with that drug families, and within families you have members, so maybe the first approach should be to choose from the existing drugs those that obviously fit better with a particular profile. And once again, it shows where these three main families, taxanes, colchicines, and vinca bind. So you have three, the same target, tubulin, but three particular binding domains on the same target. So they don't interfere with each other. You could, in principle, throw three missiles at the same target, and they will not inhibit each other. There's a new compound, pelorocide, an extract from a marine sponge off the coast of New Zealand, which is now in phase 3 clinical trials. And it has a yet new domain on tubulin to which it binds. So it could be, in principle, a fourfold attack on the same target. Very briefly, we first look at Taxol, which has been kind of beaten to death in a way, but even now, there are some new aspects to it. Interestingly, Taxol penetrates through these nanopores and binds on the inside of microtubules that I showed you earlier. And this is where the main modification may occur. We looked at the binding site of Taxol and compared paclitaxel with docetaxel, which are the same compound but different variants. This is preferred in Europe and in Canada, actually, and paclitaxel in the U.S. And we didn't find a lot of changes in the binding pocket to allow us for derivatization of it. However, almost when we were about to give up on this, we found that it diffuses through these pores. This is the outside. That's almost like a cave. It sees an opening on the surface of a microtubule, drops itself into the cave, and it's actually a bit larger than the opening, so it has to bend. That's an amazing process for something which is worth $2 billion a year. It works in many patients. And then it finds its way through the nanopore, 4 nanometers long, and emerges from the cave and binds to the binding pocket that I showed you just a moment ago. And here's the interesting thing. We found that in the cave, there's an intermediate binding site. It stops there for a while and then latches onto this M loop and swings to the final binding pocket. And there's some mutations taking place which in some cases prevent Taxol from getting there. So the differences of significance occur in the passage, not at the binding site. So we've colored here the residues of importance. 275 position, serine is substituted for alanine, and that's why we believe that in patients which overexpress beta-3 tubulin, paclitaxel in its ordinary form does not work. It actually has a very high failure rate. Its drug resistance develops within a few months of chemotherapy. And we've also designed compounds which would overcome this by making a temporary hydrogen bond with alanine in 275 position. These are the seven compounds that we are trying to get synthesized and test the hypothesis. Let me just skip through this. I mentioned drug resistance. It's an open problem. It's a very big issue because it leads to a lot of failure and a lot of suffering for patients who are exposed to these toxic substances and they don't benefit eventually. So there are many possible reasons for drug resistance, one of which may be tubulin, if it's the target, mutations or isoform expressions. Others involve efflux mechanisms like multi-drug resistance, MDR1 or P-glycoproteins, as well as other proteins, which are listed here. But I have no time to go into this issue. It's also an interesting problem for modeling and design of drugs, second generation or second line. So we've listed all the known mutations, and we found some mutations listed in the literature in the paclitaxel binding site. We believe that these mutations may, if known, a priori, could prevent the patient from being given the incorrect drug. The same for vinblastine. There's one particular mutation. We now got clinical data from all over North America for vinblastine pediatric cancers, and we found one of these mutations quite prevalent in correlated with poor outcomes. And we listed all the tubulin isotype differences which can be used for designing of drugs. In the last few minutes of my talk, I will show you some of the results of the work on colchicine derivatives as a test case for this methodology. So our target is beta-3 tubulin for several reasons. It's quite often overexpressed in cancer cells. It's more dynamic, so it's more dangerous because cells which divide a lot will want beta-3 more. And there is recent evidence from last year that beta-3 actually sensitizes not only to anti-tubulin drugs, but also to DNA-targeting drugs. So if you take out beta-3 tubulin from cancer cells, you can then use things like cisplatin more effectively. So we chose colchicine as our scaffold because colchicine was found to have a lot of differences in the actual three residues in its binding pocket which differ between beta-3 and the rest of tubulin. And we've targeted these three locations for derivatization. That's the main structure of colchicine here. And this is R1 and R2 where we did derivatization. We docked the compound to its binding site. This is shown here. And where R1 and R2 are located. This is for beta-2 tubulin, beta-3. You can see three amino acid differences. Not only are they significant because of their physical and chemical properties, but also there's a void opening in the R2 location. So we try to fill this void and see if that would lead to greater affinity of the drug for the tubulin beta 3 type. These are the compounds which we designed. So X. And the substitutions are, so this is a slightly different, X and Y are different, it's like R1 and R2 in the previous slide. And these are the listed substitutions we tried. And we made 22 compounds, not we, but our collaborators in Texas. And these are the site groups which were attached in these positions. And we first did computational prediction, and then we did the experiments. So you'll see the logic, I hope. These are the actual some of the actual derivatives as they look in 2D, and they can be superimposed. You see there and optimized. You see some of the differences. We calculated the binding energies first for each derivative against each isoform of tubulin, so that we're talking about 22 times 10, so 220 calculations. And that's the summary of these calculations. The color code indicates different form of tubulin, and I want you to pay attention to purple. Purple is our target. So if you have a bar dropping down below the horizontal axis, means that that particular compound, number 10 here, is going to bind more strongly to tubulin beta 3 than colchicine, the standard compound. So we're looking for differential activity, right? You have a compound or a library of compounds from which we want to choose those that bind more strongly to the target as opposed to the other tubulin isoforms. So this is, and 12 is another one, and 16 another one below zero. Everything above zero means it binds more weakly than colchicine. And this is in group two. We don't have too many, actual none better than colchicine. And this was then, so the compounds were synthesized, shipped to Edmonton. We did cytotoxicity assays on 11 cancer cell lines. I'll show you the ones which we tested. So it's a fairly broad panel of cancer cell lines and one normal cell line. And we measured the extinction coefficient, how fast they were dying as a colony, being exposed to these derivatives. And so if you have a very low one, that means low concentration of the drug is needed to cause the death of these cancer cells. So again, everything below this red line indicates potentially useful compounds. So out of these, we found six or seven which were useful, and some were very useful. And that shows you what side chains were added to obtain. So there is a logic to it. They preferred less bulky side chains, side groups. And we docked that to confirm that they fit better into the binding pocket that was created in beta 3. We did many more assays. I have no time to comment on all the assays, just to make sure that we were doing apoptosis, so TMRE loss, caspase activation assays, morphology. They were imaged to find out if the cells were shrinking and all the rest. And also isotype expression assays. So I'm almost done. I just want to show you the final correlation between these experimental data, which is EC50 overall on the panel of cancer cell lines. Maybe I have the list in a moment. And this is the binding energy. So you see, well, there's a 0.7 correlation coefficient between the compound, its predictive binding affinity, and the experimental cytotoxicity effect of this compound on a panel of about 22 drugs. They're numbered up to 35 for some reason, but we did only 22 drugs on this. These three are actually very promising. We call them 32, 34, and 35. They actually push down the concentration of colchicine derivatives to nanomolar concentrations, which is if that translates through this hierarchy of testing cascade stages to the human body, that would be a very promising lead compound, perhaps. because previously micromolar concentrations required of colchicine, and it failed NIH phase 2 clinical trials in 1982 and 84. Now we can use similar compounds with a similar target, more specific, at nanomolar concentrations. These are the cell, just for you, for the information of those in the audience who are biologists or cancer biologists, these are the cell lines which we tested, some lung, some breast, pancreatic, brain cancers, leukemias, and we achieved improvement except for the gliomas, which were mentioned today as pretty tough. Every other cell line we achieved improvement between 100-fold and 200-fold improvement in cytotoxic effects compared to the standard compound. And interestingly, on the normal human fibroblast cells, the cytotoxic effects were much lower. We could only kill about 20% of the cells in that normal cell population. So just to give you some raw data, so this is all real. I will stop now, but I want to only mention in passing that we, as a follow-up to this, we tried the combination because paclitaxel is a blockbuster now off patent, and it works in so many patients. Colchicine has been dropped, so we tried our best derivative with paclitaxel, and we achieved a synergistic effect. So we can even improve in combination therapy with paclitaxel. Our best colchicine derivative will improve on what paclitaxel is doing itself. And our hope is to be able. I mean, this is the chair of the oncology department recently told me that I'm totally naive and I should stop thinking about patients because we're not even thinking about patients yet, and this is a little bit embarrassing. But my hope is to bring this into maybe phase one. Because it's so unexpectedly positive. Thank you very much.